Good evening. This is the NLA Hams Net. My name is Terry from Colorado. Where in my room it's 89.0 degrees. At the airport it's 97 degrees and 11% humidity. And I know a lot of people are going to say, well, that humidity is makes 90 degrees or 97 degrees just fine. It doesn't. It's still hot.
I agree.
It's hot in my room because I have no air conditioning. Colorado and a lot of places doesn't have air conditioning. But anyway, this is Terry from Colorado. You can also look me up on the net. I'm KI0RE. That's my ham call sign. And we've been going through the ARRL tech manual that expires in June 30th of 2018 when they change all the questions. And, well, we've just kind of been walking through it, I was trying to elaborate on some of the things at the book. So, yeah, I'm reading from the Ham Radio License Manual from ARRL for the tech level technician, level one technician. And we are on page 4-12, catching back up to where I was before I went backpacking for a week. This net is held every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and all input is welcome, and we talk about anything NLA and Hamish, but mostly Hamish is what we seem to be on. If anybody has any questions, please holler. Okay, I'd like to address the blue box on the top of page 412. It says if a resonant dipole antenna is a half wavelength long, how long is that in feet? Now, this is a formula where they take it for thin wire dipoles that are lower than one half wavelength above the ground is often used, even though the estimate is usually too short at HF. So they use an example of length in feet of 400. Length in feet that dipole should be is 468 divided by the frequency in megahertz. Example, you had a 50.1 megahertz in a 6-meter band. Dipole length is calculated as 468 divided by 50.1, or 112 inches long, which is 9.33 feet. The value of the constant used in the formula accounts for effects that cause an antenna to act like it is a little longer electrically than it is physically. The actual resonant length is affected by height above ground, its electrical properties, and nearby conductive objects. Make the dipole a few percent longer at first, maybe use 490 instead of 468, then use an SWR meter. And we talked about SWR meters before. That stands for standing wave ratio. Or antenna analyzer, which will test it at various frequencies, looking for the lowest spot where the SWRs are lowest, which is what it's tuned to. So you can use an SWR meter or an antenna analyzer to determine the resonant frequency. Shorten the dipole until it is resonant at the desired frequency. This allows you to compensate for the effects of the ground or nearby conductors that might affect the antenna. For dipoles made out of wire, be sure to add a little extra wire to fasten it to the insulators. And so what you do is you leave a loop, and you measure from the end of that loop, and that loop will go around the insulator. And, of course, whatever's holding up the antenna, the rope or whatever, goes around the insulator in a 90-degree rotated fashion so that you have a clean shot, and you use that extra wire to wrap it along itself. Works real well. I wanted to cover that because sometimes I forget what the formula is. It's a quick down and dirty formula, and it's 468 divided by the frequency to give you a half-wave dipole length. And then I want to go down to figure 411, and it talks on the text on the following page, 4-13. It talks about this. I really wish we could have something like this up, but I went looking for where these might be. But, of course, they're copyrighted, and they sell a book for about $30. And if you're following along, it's easy. If you don't have the picture, it's a little harder. But on the left side of the picture, they have a regular dipole. And it looks like it's adjusted to be half wave, I'm guessing. To build a 2-meter ground plane antenna for 146 megahertz, begin with the formula 234 divided by 146 equals 19.323 inches. Start with a length of 20 inches and use an SWR analyzer or watt meter to trim the antenna to resonate at 146 meters. So it has this dipole on the left, and then it moves to a single vertical radiator, which is just a wire pointed up towards the sky, and a conductive ground plane. And the ground plane actually reflects just like you would in a mirror, and that ground plane is used as the other side, so you're kind of reflecting the image that it sees, so it looks like the other side of that dipole is down there. And then you can actually turn that in from a conductive ground plane, just a big sheet of metal, and it can be just about any conductive metal, to radials. And the radials don't work as well, but they give you plenty of ground planes, so the signal is reflected back up along the area surrounding the antenna. And we talked about that last week a little bit, or the week before, and it shows on figure 4.10 what an antenna, either vertical or horizontal, might look like. Where the power is, and it comes off the side of the antenna. Everybody, or not everybody, but there's a lot of people that have the misconception that if you want to signal something, you point the antenna where it's got to be. No, far from the truth. You want to point the side of the antenna to where you want to be, because that's where your max signal is coming up across. Okay, and then I've seen people in large HF situations where they're trying to make a ground plane of 64 radials around each antenna. I saw a guy with an array that he could phase differently out here by Platteville. He could phase it differently and make it act like a beam pointing in any direction he wanted. And he put all of his radials up about the height of up about 8 feet, or you could get to it with a step ladder. And he strung out all those radials for a half wavelength in all directions of the compass. And I think when I saw him, he had 32 radials going out from there. And his hope was that in the next year he would get 64. I don't know whether he's got it or not, but that's a fact, that the more radials you have, the better your signal will be. Well, why is that signal important? Gee, I was thinking about that today, and I said, what would Paul Revere's ride be like if he had ham radio? Well, of course, he never would have rode. He would just contacted each person down the line, woke them up as they leave the radios on because they know that the redcoats are coming. Might have gone better, might have gone worse. I don't know. But if everybody uses the correct radio discipline, he could have informed everybody at once what was happening, and they would have had more hours to prepare. Don't know exactly what they would have done, but that would have been key. Let's turn it around. What would Cornwallis or whoever was at the time, had radio communications, what would they have done if they had had them? Well, I think Valley Forge would have been a massacre, because if anybody had attacked Valley Forge, they could have taken it for almost nothing and completely decimated, and we would still be British subjects. Assuming that nothing else happened. But didn't happen like that. Now let's bring that forward. If you have radio communications, say in a county, sometimes there's obstacles that you got to get around. Here in Colorado, it's mountains. This valley doesn't hold, doesn't hear very well what's going on in the valley next to it, because there's this great big pile of dirt and rock right between it. So you, some way you got to get a repeater up on top of that hill that repeats down into the valley, or you got to find another way to bounce a signal up there and get it around. On some of the counties throughout the U.S., it's not quite that hard or difficult because the county's flat. So if you just get one big, tall antenna pole or big tower to put an antenna on top of, almost everybody in the county can see that, except in a few places where maybe a gentle hill knocks it down and gives it a shadow. Big difference all of a sudden. And the people that are serving in the county, every county should have a communications plan, and every county probably does have a communications plan, except in a few places. You should become familiar with that, if you can, maybe after you get your ham license. And kind of arrange something a little bit different, because what you find is where one radio or one strategy works, the other strategy doesn't necessarily work. And who's to say whether it's going to be their strategy or your strategy that works the best and you get the communication through? Okay, now back to the questions at hand in the study. In figure 4.11, which is at the left of the page, which I just described, what is meant by electrical mirror? And he goes into a thing where he says, if you ever put a mirror right up to somebody's face, and they could, you know, you could kind of see the mirror image of one side projected on the other side. And so you can see their whole face, but you're actually only seeing one half the face with a mirror image. That's kind of what a ground plane does. It reflects the image of the actual antenna. The more complete the ground plane, the better the reflection and more dipole-like the result. A good ground plane should extend at least one quarter wavelength, one quarter lambda, from the base of the antenna in all directions. As you might expect, since a ground plane antenna emulates a dipole, it radiates strongest perpendicular. Perpendicular to the axis of the antenna and weakest off its end. I kind of hinted at that earlier. Ground plane antennas are often called verticals because it is easiest to mount them so they are perpendicular to the ground, with the ground plane on or parallel to the ground. When mounted this way, the radiation pattern of the single element or ground plane is omnidirectional. And that's a good word. They got that one highlighted in italics. Transmitting and receiving equally well in all directions, which is the definition of omnidirectional. This type of pattern is used when there is no preferred direction of communications. Good examples of practical vertical antennas are the small whips placed on the roofs or trunks of cars. The metallic body of the car makes up the ground plane if mounted on the vehicle roof in the clear. The result is a relatively uniform radiation pattern in all directions. on the ham bands at 50 megahertz and above, these antennas give great performance at low cost, and that's a fact. You can buy a cheap or, let's say, inexpensive mag mount antenna that you put on top of your roof, and it uses the ground of the car to reflect the signal, and you get a good pattern in almost all directions. I did have a Volkswagen once that I was using before my ham days with CB, and the strongest lobe, for whatever reason, was off the left front quarter of the car, and so I could pretty much use that direction as the strongest one. So I would turn circles, and I actually found people because I used that method, turn circles and see where it's the signal is the strongest. I found a dead key that one day doing that. He swore up and down he wasn't dead keying, and I said, well, you are. And he kind of threw me off his property, and he turned it off about 5 minutes later and disconnected it, and we didn't have a problem with it again. Anyway, back to the thing. Good examples of practical vertical antennas are the small whips placed on the roofs of trunks of cars. Roofs or trunks. Now, I have to say something here. There are now cars that are made of fiberglass or plastic, and they won't stick up there. And this technique isn't going to do you that much good. But for the majority of cars that are made of metal, it will be great because you ground the radio and it grounds the signal to the ground on the car. And so your car roof is grounded and it goes fine. If you stick it on the trunk, what you're doing is part of that signal is going right through the passenger compartment. I don't like them down there as much as I like them upstairs. But you may have a problem with height. If you have a large antenna, a very long antenna, and that's why UHF and VHF are so popular. They are relatively simple, maybe 3-4 feet tall. And if you put them down on the trunk, part of your energy is going through the cabin of the car to get out. Whereas you put it on the roof, everything basically goes out the way you'd expect, and the people inside the car are shielded by the car's roof, which is metallic. So your mileage may vary. Pick the option that does best for you. And there's other ways, and you can find out as you get closer to doing that. Then it goes into talking about a 5/8 wavelength vertical antenna. And that just means that instead of using a 1/4 of the wavelength, we're going to use 5/8 of the wavelength. And it just so happens that you get a lot better resonance out of that. And because your antenna is longer, you tend to radiate a little bit more signal. The 5/8 wave vertical antenna offers some improvements over the quarter wave vertical due to its extended length. The 5/8 wave vertical focuses a bit more energy toward the horizon, improving the range. On HF bands below 24 megahertz, the increasing wavelength makes a quarter wavelength vertical less practical for portable and mobile operations. Why is that? Because a quarter length vertical at, say, 40 meters is going to be about 20 feet high. I don't think you want to put a 20-foot high antenna on the roof of your car. That would be impractical unless you don't have any bridges or tree limbs anywhere in your area, which I guess some of the Saudis, that's the way, or the Egyptians. But this isn't Saudi Arabia, nor is it Egypt. So your mileage may vary, depending upon what you do and where you are. To reduce this, and this is why they're introducing this. To reduce the physical size of the antenna, it is often constructed with some of the radiating conductor wound into a coil or a separate inductor inserted in the antenna. This technique is called inductive loading, and it makes the antenna longer electrically than it is physically. And I could show you, if I had a whiteboard, I could show you why, but I'm not going to do it here or try to do it. Just know that anytime you put inductance into an antenna, it tends to make the antenna look longer. Now, that allows a shorter antenna to be placed on top of a car. Maybe you've seen that. The old K40CB antenna had a great big coil at the bottom and a little bitty radial. And the radial is only 3 feet high, 4 feet high maybe at the out. And yet it was one of the kicking us antennas. It would put out a great signal. Same thing. I have an antenna that I use in my car quite often. It's in the back of the car right now because I used it a few weeks ago. And it has two coils spaced precisely where they need to be. One loads up the bottom, and it's for VHF. The other one is a top load that makes the top a little longer, but it's for UHF. And so it's a dual band antenna, and yet it has a 3 dB and a 6 dB gain on it because they put the loads where they need to be. So you can accomplish amazing things. And I want to extend it as we talk here, that if inductance improves it makes the antenna look longer electrically, what do you think capacitance will do? And the answer, of course, is capacitance makes an antenna look shorter. Sometimes that's good. Sometimes that's what you want. Sometimes not. But you'll see some antennas. I have an old CB antenna that had three little radials about a foot long at the very top. And that made a little capacitive hat for the antenna. And it allowed the antenna to be a little longer than it needed to be, but that extra stuff, that extra length, was compensated by that electrical cap so that you send out a nice strong signal outside of the antenna. And it worked a little better than plain old 5/8 hanging out there. It was an interesting antenna. I liked it. Okay, any questions so far? Holy cow, I ran them all off, Jan.
That does happen from time to time.
Okay, the last thing I wanted to cover in here is this blue box at the bottom of page 4-13, antennas for handheld radios. And what they do is that a lot of ham radios, including the Bofangs, come with a short, rubbery-coated antenna that is only about 6 inches long. Well, if you work out a quarter wavelength of a VHF signal, is somewhere in the vicinity of about 2-3 feet. Well, that antenna doesn't look long enough. Well, what they do is they wind it around a flexible post and then seal it all up. So the antenna is wound around, and it gives the electrical appearance of being longer for the HT. So they work. They don't work as well as a full-fledged antenna. I have two antennas that I bought after I bought my Bofang. One is a flexible antenna that's a little longer. It actually approaches a quarter wave antenna. but it's real flexible. That does a pretty good job. And then I have a telescoping antenna that telescopes out to about 4 feet. I know that that one gets out and works a little better than the little rubber ducky that it came with. But it's the nice thing about an HT is you can work from the car. Well, if you're working from a car, what do you got surrounding you? You have a Faraday cage. It has some windows in it, but your signal, and they quote a factor of 10 to 20 times less signal getting out through your windows. And if your windows are tinted, that's a small, thin layer of metal. And oftentimes that'll knock it down even further. So be careful what you do, and you're much better off buying an antenna that fits your antenna connector on your Bofang. You take off the old rubber ducky, and whenever you get in the car, you plug that antenna in. It's up on the top. It's magnetically attached. And now your antenna is completely outside the cabin of the car. Works very well. Another thing in using an antenna or using the HT is that your body is pretty much resonant at VHF frequencies, 144 to 148 handband megahertz. When you hold it up, you don't want to point the antenna at what you're trying to talk to. You hold it straight up because most of the antennas that are going to be listening to you, which means most of the repeater antennas, but it also could mean most of the antennas that other people around the county are using, they're going to be pointing straight up too. If you're trying to turn them clockwise, or horizontal, you have a different polarization, and your transfer of signal from one radio to another or one radio to a repeater, which is another radio, becomes a little more difficult. It's not as efficient. So try and hold that thing straight up and down. Also, because your body is resonant, you actually act as the ground plane. And so being the ground plane, the signal is reflecting off of you to get where it's got to go. And one thing that you don't think about when using that until you get into fox hunting or something like that is face where you want the signal to go. And if you can, you got a speaker mic, hold it away from your body at about a quarter wavelength. Why? Why would you do that, Terry? Because you're actually, the signal coming off the antenna is reflecting off of you and getting back. And so if you extend your hand a little bit, not a long ways, but just a little bit off your body, it tends to reinforce the signal that's going out. The signal reflecting off of you combines with the signal coming out the antenna, and you get a little bit more power out of it. It happens the other way, too. When we're doing fox hunts, often you can get close to a fox, and every rock and tree and piece blade of grass and tube and everything else, everything in sight, it looks like it's radiating energy. And you want to decide, well, which one is really telling me which way to go? So what you do is you hold the radio upside down so the main mass of your body is just right off of the radio. Maybe it's 12 inches away from you. And you look for a dip in the signal because the dip in the signal is your body covering up the received signal. It's being controlled by your body. And so you look at that, and then you turn around 180 degrees and say, the signal I'm chasing is back that direction. And lots of times in the final stages of a fox hunt, we'll take the antennas off altogether. So it's got to be very close. The radio has to be very close to where the signal is coming from or it doesn't hear it. So that way you take this thing where you, it looks like everything in the in your immediate vicinity, trees and fence posts and road and everything else, rocks, they're all radiating this signal. Well, they are in a way because they're all bouncing something off. Take the antenna out and you go close to the tree, it's not radiating. You go close to the rock, it's not radiating. You go close to the fence post, there's your signal. And you look at fence post and it's got a little hollow thing in the top and maybe it's got a radio stuffed in there. You just never know. But you can do a little direction finding with that little HT if you work at it. Let's see, did I cover everything? I think I did. Okay, any questions? Comments, suggestions, criticisms, toe jelly, whatever you want. Okay, well, we got about 15 minutes, about 10 before I have to start logging off here. So I'll just go to the next page, 4-14. There's some pictures at the top of a Yagi, which has some precisely spaced elements. A Yagi was created by a guy named Yagi, Y-A-G-I, and the driven element is usually one in front of the far back element. And the back element is like 105% long. The driven element is tuned to the frequency. And then your directing elements, you can have any number of those. The original Yagi only had one. And it's at 95% the size. So you actually get the ends are reflecting off. And they make a big difference in how directional the signal is. But you can have a whole bunch of directors up there that'll keep bouncing the signal the way it's supposed to go. So it has a example of a Yagi and a quad antenna. They're beam antennas because they focus the figure 4-4.13 shows that directionally the half power point is about 30 degrees either side of where it's pointing. And you do have a little back scatter that comes in. A signal can come in the side, but it's not amplified as much as directly in front of the antenna. The quads are the same way. And they said something I didn't realize here. Yagi and quad antennas are beam antennas that focus radiated power along their axes. Yagi elements are tubes or rods and can be oriented horizontally, as shown here, or vertically. Quad elements are one wavelength loops. By feeding the driven element of a quad at different points, the radiated signal can be made either horizontally or vertically polarized. So I haven't used the quad antenna. I can't talk to it much, and I didn't know they were full wavelength. That's kind of strange to me. But it talks about directional antennas, and it talks about some dishes. You don't have to know a whole lot about that. There are only four questions in the question pool. Maybe they use one of those. It just all depends. I leave that up to the reader. The idea is that you're concentrating reception of signals from a specific direction. When you get up into stuff that's going to, there's a figure 4.14 is a guy with his, how big is his dish? It's a 10-meter dish. Doesn't look like a 10-meter dish. I guess it is. Because 10 meters is roughly 33 feet, somewhere in there. And his dish doesn't look 33, but the photo might be messing with the scale because it's further back than he is. But he uses that to bounce the signal off the moon. And the idea is that a parabolic mirror, why the reason they use a paraboloid is that you can have a center feed, and no matter what angle it feeds, it's all going to go out in a parallel beam all the same direction if you get it all tuned right and centered right physically. So he points that at the moon, and he bounces signal off the moon, which is very weak, but he can talk to the entire hemisphere of the planet listening to that moon, which is kind of cute. And then on the right side, they got a little bitty, N7 CFO's much smaller dish he listens to on, 10 gigahertz. Well, 10 gigahertz, if you think about it, the wavelength on 10 gigahertz is going to be very, very short. And I don't know all the things they do, but I know that they sometimes use phased array antennas to make it a little stronger in one direction than any other. And you can communicate over long distances that way, but it's all got to be line of sight. It all has to be aligned precisely so that you're looking right down the other antenna's throat. And if you get off just a little bit, so you usually have one person transmitting, and you adjust onto them until you get the strongest signal you can, and they do the same thing to you, and then you can communicate, and it's very clean communication. Sounds great, but it takes a little work to get there. So a couple of places that ham radio goes that some people like it a lot more. And, you know, that's the thing about amateur radio. It's for exploring and experimenting. And so taking the time to experiment means a lot. And you get the knowledge as you experiment. You get the knowledge that maybe other people don't have. And you begin to develop a skill on how to communicate electronically. What piece of that ham radio, what piece of that antenna knowledge, what piece of that skill on orienting your antenna or talking on the radio or the setup you got becomes critical, you don't know until you look at your situation. And as long as you keep that in mind, you practice the things that work for you. Give you an example. Here in Colorado, we have mountains. Well, one way to overcome mountains is you put a repeater up. The repeater hears a big area, but there's still blind spots. Another way is you string a HF antenna along the ground, maybe raised 18 or 20 inches, 18 inches, somewhere in there, whatever's convenient. And you lay out a dipole. And then you transmit, and what it does, it bounces off the ground. Because it's laid along parallel to the ground, the main direction of the signal coming out of that very long wire is perpendicular to the antenna, which is now vertical. And it goes up and it hits one of the layers in the atmosphere and bounces back down. Well, one of the layers it hits, and when it bounces back down, one of those signals is just enough to get it over the mountain that you're right next to. And somebody else with a similar setup can communicate with you because you're bouncing off one of the atmospheric layers. Instead of trying to go hundreds of miles, you're just trying to go far enough to where you get over the mountain. And since the F1, F2 layer is up there at about, I said before, I don't remember what the number of miles is, but it's bigger than any mountain we got here in Colorado, which is pretty good size. And so it'll come back down and you can talk. There's hundreds of these little things that if you study them, you become better at communicating using ham radio, which increases the capability of your committee of safety. And that is, after all, what we're trying to go for. We're trying to provide communications for a community of safety, for a committee of safety, across an entire county that we're formed under. And the better you get at your job, the better the committee, the more effective the committee of safety can be. And with that, I think we're getting close to the time. Does anybody have any questions, comments, criticisms, or anything else that they'd like to interject? Please call now. The silence was deafening. This is KI0RE. I'm Terry in Colorado, and I hold the NLA HamsNet every week at this time, 6 p.m. or 8 p.m. Eastern Time, to about 8:45. And everybody's welcome to contribute. This net is held once a week on Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. And everyone is welcome to talk about NLA and/or ham stuff. So with that, I thank everyone for participating, and I thank you that you could attend and listen to the net. And I'll call the net closed. Thank you, Jan. Jan, you up? Anybody else there?
Yeah, I just got back on. I got dumped on Skype and it didn't like my password.
Ouch. That's what I lost my old user ID because of that. But anyway, let's go ahead and close the recording.
Okay.